Hello and welcome to the You Matter podcast. For the past couple of days, the entire nation of India has been swamped and overwhelmed by the grieving news of the young actor Sushant Singh Rajput ending his life at the young age of 34, battling mental illness and not being verbal about it. And all of a sudden, there is a revolution within the entire Bollywood industry, within social groups, within youngsters, where a conversation has started, where people are lifting these drapes of this illusion of a perfect world where mental health and mental illness can be kept aside and not be spoken about. It's amazing that finally people have taken the time out to address the elephant in the room. And I couldn't think of a better timing to do this podcast. Now, many of you know that I am a person who has bipolar type 2. Hence, I've been an advocate and a preacher about the importance of mental health and mental well-being for the past couple of years. And this episode, I am dedicating to the importance of mental health. And I'm going to be throwing some light on what it is like to live with bipolar disorder type 2. With me in conversation is Lindsay, and she's joining us all the way from the United States of America. And without further ado, I'll take this opportunity to introduce or have her introduce herself on the show. All right. Hi, Lindsay, and welcome to the You Matter podcast. It's such an honor to have you featuring for our podcast episode on bipolarity.
I'm really excited to be here and really looking forward to having a very authentic conversation about bipolar disorder.
All right, Lindsay. So let's start off with a little bit of an introduction. I would like the listeners to know a little bit about you, where you come from. How did you get diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and what's your journey been like, you know, till here?
Yeah, absolutely. I can go into that. So I'm from Dallas, Texas, right outside of Dallas. I went to University of Oklahoma, then I lived in DC for a while, and now I am at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. I got diagnosed with bipolar disorder when I was 22. I've been experiencing swings for a while. My mental health journey is actually, and I think that this is reflective, especially in a lot of women with bipolar disorder. I had a really bad eating disorder when I was 15, 16, and was in the hospital for a while. And that was really the beginning of my mental health journey. I'm a firm believer that my eating disorder was a manifestation of my bipolar disorder. It was just kind of almost like my way of getting help before I knew what was going on with me. I knew there was something wrong. And then once I turned 21, I started getting very swingy. So all my friends would know me as like, LOL, Lindsay just stays up for like 6 nights at a time. And they're like, how do you have time to do all this painting? And it was because I was mentally ill. But I would be up for 6 days at a time, super manic. I had in DC, my whole apartment was covered in these really intricate murals because I would stay up all night just like painting murals on my wall. And obviously just a lot of hypersexuality, a lot of really crazy decisions. Like one time in a manic swing, I woke up, I was in Prague. Just what? Some crazy shit. Yeah. And eventually though, I feel like everybody has that voice, right? That really negative, bad voice in their head. And, it got to the point where I was in my head, like it was just constantly like, kill yourself, kill yourself, kill yourself, kill yourself all day, every day. And I was like, this isn't normal. And I'm really privileged to have had that mental health care early on in my life. So I was able to kind of recognize signs of like mental illness. And I was able to be like, okay, I'm telling myself to kill myself, you know, 100 times a day, and I haven't slept in 6 days. There's probably something wrong. And yeah. So I went to a couple of doctors, and I think it's really important to highlight some of the injustices in the US mental health system. Can't really speak on behalf of everything else, but my first doctor I went to literally told me to track my period because my mood swings, you know, I'm using air quotes, he was like, track your period because I'm pretty sure that it's going to correspond with your mood swings. And I was like, sir, I've had an IUD for the last 7 years. Bitch, haven't gotten my period in 7 years. That's not it. But yeah, I mean, and so for me, I'm lucky that I kind of had that like knowledge of, no, that's not true. But if somebody did it, I mean, that's so dangerous. Anyways, I ended up with an amazing psychiatrist named Alexa, shout out Alexa. About 2 minutes into me sitting down talking with her, she was like, you have textbook bipolar two. Like, I just like, you're going to be, and she said, she's like, you're going to be A-okay. Like, you're going to be fine. This is treatable. Like, but it's textbook bipolar two. And, I was just so relieved. I was like, oh, it's something. Like, okay. And she gave me a couple of medications, and I have this one line a day diary, and you can really track my manic swings based off of my handwriting, because when I'm manic, it's like, and I have this one that I saved like on my phone and everything, and it says, you know, I finally feel like myself again, and I didn't realize that was possible. And that was a couple, you know, it took a couple months, obviously. But that's my main mental health journey. Obviously, I still have swings. I still have things that I still struggle, of course. But that initial first step to just figuring out what was wrong, I think was the biggest hurdle thus far.
You know, the reason why I asked you this is, for me, on the other hand, it wasn't that clear. I didn't really know that there was something wrong with me, you know. I just thought I'm not able to deal with stress. I said, okay, probably like, you know, everyone reacts differently to stress, and this is how I react. Because when I started showing signs was when I was away from home. I was doing my college, doing engineering, and I was staying alone, living in this one small puny little apartment all on my own. I kind of felt that probably this place is getting to me. I'm staying away from family. There's no one to talk to. Probably that's the reason this is happening to me. But much later is when I finally realized that, okay, there's something really wrong and I need to see a doctor. You know, like for me, a point came where I could literally hallucinate. I could see things. I'm having conversations. And like I realized that, okay, things are going haywire at this point of time. Like, you know, I really need some help. And I don't know, I mean, at least in the media, it's portrayed like mental health is not that much of a taboo in the United States. I might be wrong, but back home in India over here, it's huge taboo. It's huge taboo. Yeah. Like, you know, like you can, if you're mentally ill, it's almost like, okay, that you're messed up. Like, you know, you're screwed up in some way or the other. So it wasn't that easy to even come home and you just tell that to my parents. But then I finally took the guts and I called mom one day and I told her, like, you know, mom, this is what the doctor says. Like, I've got bipolar too. And my mom was a sweetheart. Like, you know, in the next 5 days, she put an application for leave. She flew down. She came down. She was in Saudi Arabia at that point of time. And I was in Bangalore, India. She flew down to Bangalore, stayed with me for around 3 weeks. Just like told me, like, you know, you just relax, do your thing, do whatever is required. Just, I'm just going to be here. Yeah. But that was the start. And this I'm talking about is around 7 years back. How was it for you?
What did we do to deserve moms? Yeah, honestly.
I swear. Yeah. So this was 7 years back. The reason why I brought this up is because how was it? For you to talk to your parents about it, you know, because something about healing is not just you doing it, but it's the environment around you. People around you need to be that much of a support. How is it for you?
I am so privileged, and it's something that I talk about a lot, and I really recognize is that my parents were so supportive. My parents were the ones where, you know, when I had my eating disorder a while ago, they were the ones that were like, we're going to get you mental health care. We're going to go into a hospital. We are going to have family therapy, and we are going to like figure this out. And it did really shift the dynamic of my family and how we communicated and how we understood mental health. So by the time that I called my parents and I was like, hey, it's bipolar disorder. It actually runs in my family. And my mom was literally like, oh, thank God. Like, thank God. Like, we, you know, just like, which is such a crazy thing to say. But my mom was like, okay, that's it. Like, we have experience. It's a little scary because a lot of the people in my family are bipolar and untreated. And I think watching them ruin their lives, frankly, for not getting the treatment that they needed and really ruining their lives made me even more certain about, like, there was never a question of, like, oh, should I get on medication or should I do this? It felt like my parents treated it like I had called them and told them I had diabetes. You know, just like kind of a serious thing that we need to, you know, definitely address and that will affect you for the rest of your life. But it's not something that they were ashamed about or something that they were particularly like, oh my God, you're going to die. You know, they were like, okay, this is something that we need to deal with. And they educated themselves and learned a lot. And that is not indicative of a lot of places in the United States. I'm really lucky. Mental health care is slowly becoming less taboo and more people are talking about it. But still, especially if you get to some places in the South or depending on communities, I've been doing just with all the Black Lives Matter, you know, protests and with the police brutality and everything like that. One of the things I've been focusing on is highlighting Black voices in mental health and learning about Black Americans where therapy and mental health is really taboo in a lot of those communities. So, you know, the US, as per usual, has a lot of diversity in terms of what is acceptable and, you know, what mental health care actually means.
Yeah, thank you for just reminding me that I actually wanted to put this out there because, for everyone who's listening, Lindsay's been doing fantastic with regard to this, the entire campaign of Black Lives Matter. I'm loving the content that she's been putting up on her Instagram handle. She's been talking about Black mental health, and it's amazing to see a different perspective because right now we are talking so much of the injustice that is happening to a particular race, but even the mental health aspect, it's such an untouched yet such a deep crevice that exists in society, and it's amazing at the beautiful spotlight Lindsay's been putting up on it. I would like everyone to just like take the time out, go and follow her on Instagram. That's Lindsay_Rose_Wise. I'll be putting her Insta handle in the bio of this podcast as well. So please go and give her a shout out for the amazing work that she's been doing. Lindsay, huge fan. And I actually want to even tell people how I came across this profile because for the longest time when I started talking about bipolar disorder, I needed to find someone who I could connect with on the same topic. And I actually tried to search for influencers who have been talking about the same topic. And I still feel that people still try to sugarcoat it. There's this way of trying to talk about it like... you know, nobody wants to talk about the harsh realities of it, like how hard it is for a person with bipolar disorder to pass a single day. You know, how to, even once diagnosed and you start medication, how hard it is for you to not get addicted to that medication and not live life only through that medication, but to start living without that medication.
Yeah, or even how hard it is to, this is like maybe TMI, but how hard it is to orgasm once you start antidepressants.
Exactly.
It just sucks. Like, people don't talk about this shit.
Everyone wants to put like a silencer on the gun and then fire it. So I stumbled upon Lindsay's profile and my like I went through her you know, those Insta stories which you can save and I kind of saw the content that she put up and I really could resonate and connect with what she was saying, and that's when I got in touch with her. And she's a beautiful soul. I've had a gala of a time talking to her for the past 2 days. Doing this podcast actually is actually on a 2 weeks delay. I was actually supposed to do this podcast 2 weeks back, but then I've been waiting for this and I knew that it's going to come and it's going to come sweet. So thank you, Lindsay. And taking it forward, I also want you to throw some light on the hypersexuality part, because as we mentioned, we were uncensored. This is where I want you to address.
Yeah, hypersexuality, my favorite topic, or just sexuality in general. I am a big sex positive person. But when I was about 21. I had just moved to DC. I had I'd gotten hot for the first time, like really hot. Like I was really like enjoying that I had grown into my hotness. And I was just like, I'm a sexual being. And women are so often told to stifle their sexuality. So I had actually come from a very conservative, I went to school at the University of Oklahoma. It was very conservative. There was a lot of slut shaming. I was really cautious about my sexuality when I was in college because there's just this like strong Southern religious culture that permeates throughout the university and frankly the South. And so it wasn't until I got to DC that I was suddenly like, oh, I can sleep with who I want as long as I want to sleep with them. And it turns out when I was manic, I wanted to sleep with everybody, or at least anybody. So I would go, I had a bar next to my house. And when I was manic, I would go to the bar just at night when I was done my work or whatever. I would just go in, I would pick up a dude, bring him back to my place, sleep with him, and kick him out 2 hours later. And that probably happened like 8 times a week. I mean, double on days. It was nuts. And it's still, so now I'm medicated, but that doesn't mean that I still don't experience manic and depressive swings. And sometimes things need to get altered a little bit in terms of medication and stuff. It still happens. And it's something that I feel like is more controllable now. But I think that that's what the medication does, is it makes you feel like you can control these impulses, but it doesn't get rid of the impulses. And I have to actively be like, hey, Lindsay, don't try to sleep with that male friend who you're not even attracted to. And it also really, one of the ways I had to switch my mindset, and I think this is important for everybody, but especially if you're experiencing hypersexuality with bipolar disorder, is the two questions, or the one question I used to ask myself before I slept with a guy was, do I want to sleep with him? That was all that was the chat box, right? Do I want to sleep with him? If I do, yes, cool, we'll sleep with him. I have found that something that's helped me curb the hypersexuality and really like bring myself back to center when I'm feeling a little bit out of control is the thought of the second check needs to be, do they deserve to sleep with me? And I found that often that answer is no. Like often they do not deserve to sleep with me. And even if I want to sleep with them, I'm not going to, because you know what? Wanting to do something is not a good enough reason to do something for anything, right? Like, why did you do that? Because I wanted to. That's not an excuse for anything. It shouldn't be an excuse for sleeping with people who don't deserve to be inside of you, you know? I mean, so that's what I use now. Does it work all the time? Absolutely not. Have I gotten manic since I've been medicated and slept with somebody who does not deserve to fuck me? Yup. But significantly less. And that's the, I think that is the progress, right? It's not linear.
So, you know, okay, so I'm just coming off binging the entire Jeffrey Epstein documentary on Netflix, Filthy Rich. And my God, like, my wife was about to, like, break the TV in anger, you know. But there's something that I found over there and something that I could relate to. So if you notice this, I mean, so when I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, there was one thing of understanding the disease. All right, of understanding the disorder. And there was another thing of then accepting it and being vocal about it. And there was some kind of redemption in being vocal about it. And I think I could resonate with that coming out of that series, because when one victim finally started speaking up, there were people who then spoke up about it. The Me Too campaign is an example of that as well.
Yeah,
that, you know, the
network effect.
The network effect. Like, you know, you have people who are going through the same thing. And when you voice it out, being vocal about it in some way or the other kind of helps you get a better hand on the disorder, right? So I want to know how that has been for you, because you're very verbal about it. And I mean, you're an advocate about mental health. So how has that been for you?
I think I want to word this correctly. is that at least for me, the way that the disease manifests itself is very isolating, right? Like the thing that bipolar disorder wants to do is isolate you. The way that I really learned to cope with bipolar disorder by personifying it, which might sound weird, but I really feel as though I have this like destructive, invasive parasite in my head that is trying to, that's how I think of it, like a parasite. And it's trying to invade my thoughts and my feelings and my actions. And it's foreign, it's not me. And I think that's been the best way, because the reason why people don't talk out about it is shame, right? For many reasons. But once you realize like, this isn't me, this isn't who I am, this is a foreign disease that I have that is affecting me, you're not ashamed about it anymore, because it's not your fault. It's not your, you know, it's something else. So talking about my bipolar disorder didn't feel like an attack on me anymore. It was really important for me to separate myself from my bipolar disorder. At this point, I have conversations with my bipolar disorder. Like I'm a nutso. I have a voice of like, the voice in your head, right? You can call it the voice. My family refers to it as ED, which stands for eating disorder. Like my mom would be like, that's just ED talking. And I know exactly what she's talking about. So that's the first thing, is that once I was able to really separate out and personify and vilify my bipolar disorder, it became easier to talk about it. The other two things are, and I keep going back to this eating disorder thing, but it was very formative in terms of how I dealt with things later in my life, is that when I got back to high school after having spent a year in and out of the hospital, I got back to high school and some bitch who I had literally never really interacted with, I wasn't cool in high school, and this was like a very cool girl, started this rumor that I had gotten pregnant and had a janky abortion. And that is why I was out of school for that long. And that was awful to return to. So I come back and all 700 kids in my class think that I had gotten a bad abortion, which is just so, like, that doesn't, just shows how in Texas we're not taught about like sexual wellness and health, because the chances of me getting quote unquote a bad abortion and having to be gone out of school for a year, like, that's just not generally like how abortions work. But I just started telling people. I was like, no, I wasn't pregnant. I had an eating disorder and I was in the hospital, because that sounded better than what they thought about me. So from a very young age, I was kind of forced to be open about it, which I'm not saying is a good thing. And I'm sad that I did have to do that. But at the same time, it did make me have to stop being ashamed and have to start being open and honest and breaking down some of those barriers. Because back then mental health wasn't a thing, right? It's really only become a thing in the last maybe 5 years. When I was a kid, like, that wasn't talked about. I remember my mom being like, Lindsay, can you just promise me you're going to stop throwing up? As if I could have just stopped being bulimic. And once, it, you know, she's the most supportive and she educated herself and learned a lot, but just in the beginning, no one knew shit about mental health. That just wasn't a fucking thing. Those are my two things. It's easy to be open when you've been open for so long, and it's easier to be open when you disassociate with your bipolar disorder, when you realize that it is not you.
Got it. Lindsay, another thing about, you know, accepting mental illness and, you know, being a part of your life is how hard it is to be in relationships, because now you need to have someone who understands this, understands who you are. I mean, it's hard enough to understand a person and now accept them with the baggage that the one thing that you want to connect with them, that is, you know, on an intellectual level or just soul to soul, you realize that, oh my God, this person is going to have mood swings. Round the clock, and, you know, they're like a ticking time bomb. You cut the wrong wire and then, you know, it's kaboom. So how has relationships been for you? Like, you know, with getting people to accept you with this?
I don't know if I'm the one to talk on how to have successful relationships. But also, I do have the disclaimer that I am 25 and I am just now starting to be like, maybe it's time for me to look for somebody who I can actually see a future with, as opposed to just like someone who's fun. That being said, I have found that transparency from the beginning is really important. And letting them know what to expect. So the kindest thing a boyfriend has ever told me is one time I was in a pretty bad depressive swing for a couple of days. And I told him, I was like, I'm so sorry. I feel guilty. I feel like I'm not talking to you. I feel like I'm not, you know, I feel so distant and I want to connect, but I just can't right now. Like I can't, but I do want you here with me. And he just looked at me and said, of course, Lindsay, just sometimes you're quiet. And that's okay. And it was just the nicest, most accepting way of, you know, just sometimes I am quiet. And then you also have to balance two things. And I was actually just speaking about this with another friend who has some mental illness struggles, is do you want to be with somebody who also has mental illness struggles so they can understand it? Or do you want to be with somebody who, you know, what is the best support system? I still am unsure. I have found, though, that when I am with people who don't have any mental health issues, I sometimes get so like, it's just like, oh, you sweet summer child. Like, you know, it's crazy for, I'm like, you don't tell yourself to kill yourself 20 times a day. That's crazy. Like what? I forget that people don't live with mental illness. And so it just it's honestly harder for me to connect with. There seems to be this missing piece. But I am not saying that that is exclusive to everybody. And I don't think that that's forever. I think it's just, saying from the beginning, you know, look, my being bipolar is in my Insta bio, so it's not exactly a secret. And as with Forbes, right? I mean, we are not aloof or mysterious people about that. But I think just being in the beginning, like educating people and being really open and honest and telling them, like, there are no dumb questions if they don't have experience with bipolar disorder. I've also found, and now I'm just a little bit rambling, but I've also found I had a boyfriend once whose father had bipolar disorder, but it was not treated. He was diagnosed, had been on medication, went off medication because he like didn't like the way it made him feel, and is just, I mean, like obviously problematic for the family. He was bipolar one. So, I mean, like it would be stuff where we would, you know, just be in bed and his dad would call him at 2 a.m. being like, hey, Donald Trump just called me and said that you shouldn't be getting on airplanes right now. I just wanted to let you know. I mean, just obviously, yeah, like delusionally manic, right? Okay. Just like, holy shit, like you are an adult. Get the fuck back on your lithium. just do that shit. But I found that in something I had to just tell him point blank was, you cannot let your perception of your father's bipolar disorder leak into your perception of my bipolar disorder. Because we are two different people. B, because it's bipolar one versus bipolar two. Like I'm fortunate that while I get manic and hypersexual, I've never lost touch with reality. And three, like I'm not only medicated, I go to mental health professionals, I'm supported by my family, like it's just different. Yeah. And I remember him feeling very offended that I said that, and I was like, I'm not expecting you to, but just your internal unconscious bias is going to do something. And I wanted to call that out before it happened. So those are the things that I think are important. I would love to hear about, you know, I mean, obviously you're married to this badass bitch of a woman. I would love to hear a little bit about how you deal and how she supports.
Yeah. So that the reason why I asked you is because I really think I got it lucky, you know? So I met my wife, in 2015 in another friend's wedding, and a random friend's wedding. We met each other. and we kind of connected because we were the only two who went to take a hit in the wedding, like we went outside.
Yes.
And I could smell some green, and I'm like, okay, I need to find who's this. And then I found her.
Oh my
over
God.
There.
I've made all my friends, like literally all my best friends have been because I was smoking at an event where no one else was smoking. okay, keep going. I love the story already.
Yeah. So we connected there, and then she turned out to live just like right across the street. You know, we hadn't met each other all our life, and she was right across the street. So I dropped her back home, and then we were just really good friends. She had a studio. She's an artist, as you know. So I used to go once in a while to the studio. She used to keep painting. We used to smoke a doobie, just order in. And that went on for a year and a half. And one fine day, we both sat down and we gone to this restaurant, and we got smashed drunk. Like, we got smashed drunk, very honest. And both were cursing relationships. And we were like, you know, marriage is not our thing. And I said, yeah, marriage is not my thing as well. And she's like, you know, this is why I don't want to get married with someone. And she listed down like a set of 7-8 problems. And then I listed down my problems. Like, this is why I don't want to get married with someone. You know, these are the reasons. And then we just like compared notes. And then I realized, like, I said, I'm okay with making a deal with the list of things that you have put down, as long as you're okay to make a deal with the things that I have put down. And she said, yeah, this actually makes sense. I think I can do that. And for me, on the top of that was, I'm bipolar type too. You know, I come with this. So you need to be extra patient, and it's going to be an uphill task. And she's like, yeah, I'm up for it. And then she told me her stuff. Like, she's like, you know, I PMS real bad, I PCOD, and all of this is there. And, you know, so I said, yeah, I think we can work it out. So because we knew each other as friends really well. So we decided, I said, okay, let's just date each other. You know, let's just date and see if this works. And so we dated for, say, around six to eight months. And I think almost 1 year after we dated, exactly on the date we turned one, I proposed to her. And then she said,
yes, you did.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, this sounds just so healthy and cute. And oh my God.
That's why I said, Lindsay, I think I got lucky because, I mean, she's been a sweetheart.
Oh, you got lucky as shit. Are you kidding me? I create, your wife is just like he brags on his wife all the time, but like she is like the hottest humanitarian I've ever seen. Like she's both things. She's like hot and cool and helps people. So yeah, and is apparently like really in tune with EQ and mental health. So yeah, you got real fucking lucky, dude.
Yeah, dude. So that worked out for me. So, you know, in a nutshell, that really worked out for me. But I've been wondering, like, was that something that I realized, like, not everyone would be as lucky as me, you know, like they are going to be, because before I started dating her, before we got into a relationship, I was on a roller coaster ride of relationships, like, you know, because I always to play the gamble. Do I put this right up there and chase her away in the first five dates, or do I, you know, keep it and tell it to her much later and, you know, ease her into it that this is part of who I am.
You don't want to seem deceptive, but yes. You don't want to seem like you've been keeping a secret from them the whole time, but you also don't want to scare them off immediately. I just think, sorry to interrupt. I just think my general rule now, and you know, it hasn't been this way forever, but now that I'm very secure in myself, is most of the time at least, is like I tell them immediately, because if it scares them away, or if they say that they can't handle it, that's just not a person I need in my life. And mostly because while I recognize that, like, whoever is going to be my partner in life is going to have to be an emotional support for me, I also do have my shit together, and I do have a support system outside of them. I'm very strong. I know when to reach out for help when I need it, but I don't think that my bipolar disorder would, you know, makes being in a relationship with me unbearable. Like, I think that what I offer is significantly more than than the burden that my bipolar disorder places. And if that isn't apparent to somebody pretty immediately, I mean, I'm a cool fucking chick. If that's not apparent immediately, like, I just don't need that.
Lindsay, it's been fantastic. We have had a brilliant discussion over the past half an hour on your journey, on hypersexuality, how it is to be verbal about and being an advocate about bipolarity, and what it is like to be in a relationship having bipolar disorder. I think there's more in store for us in this episode. And I think we're going to let it spill over to a second segment. And that completely depends on you, though. Do you have the time for another segment?
Yeah, absolutely. I am very excited. I have a lot more to say. So I would love to continue our conversation and have a second segment.
All right. So before we move to the second segment, I would like you to give a shout out to, you know, all your handles so that people could follow you and, you know, start looking at your content before they log on to the second segment.
Sounds great. So you can follow me on Instagram at Lindsay_Rose_Weiss. I talk a lot about bipolarity and mental health and living with bipolar disorder. You can also follow me on my art Insta handle at tits_and_art, which is when you can see self-explanatory, a lot of tits and art. And finally, I have my own podcast, Sufficiently High, C-H-A-I, where we get a little high and talk a little Torah. So if that interests you, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcasts, and you can follow us at Sufficiently High, C-H-A-I on Instagram.
Thank you, Lindsay, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you so much. Can't wait.